Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeta, Evan Basilek, Russell Young, and Sujeet DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information, should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 214, being recorded on the 31st of January, 2018, with special guest Nir Mashkowski. I'm Sujeet, and on Skype with me, I have Evan, Russell, and our special guest Nir. Kale's at an internal conference in Seattle this week, and he's not sure if he could join, so we figured let's just get started. And thanks for putting all those links in the show notes, especially Russell put a whole bunch in there. Russell, do you want to start with one of them?
Yeah, hi, Sujeet. The first one, I guess, is the GA of Azure Event Grid. So fairly new service to Azure. And I love this service. So it's all about event-driven programming. It's extensible, so you can put custom custom events into it and then publish with a pub subtype model out to various different consumers and subscribers on the other end. So it's just been gone GA this week.
Right, and it kind of is related to the discussion we're going to have with Nir later today, so I'm sure that'll come up. Evan, is there something that you
like? I got to talk about the ExpressRoute stuff, although I actually did not see that announcement, but I am going to talk about it. So we've got a couple of new cool things coming with ExpressRoute. So we're partnering up with Cisco to really leverage some of their network expertise as a business and creating some new services and features with them. And that's going to be in kind of managing customers' ExpressRoute environments. So there's going to be more of that stuff coming. We also have released Network Performance Monitor for ExpressRoute, right? And that shows some of your topology, it shows your usage, a lot of interesting information about your circuit at that point. And then the last part of that, which I think was already public, but I don't know that we publicized it, was that we've merged the public and Microsoft peerings into one single peering. So effective sometime this fall, all new circuits after that date have merged peering. So you'll have basically what we call Microsoft peering, which is all of our public cloud services, Office and Azure, and then we have private peering for your virtual machines you deploy.
Wow, yeah, I know that our customer has definitely had some issues, and that update that you just talked about with the peering being merged is going to help them a lot. That's something that they've been struggling with. So
The Microsoft peering is if you do it right, it adds a ton of value, but it certainly is the kind of thing that, because we're injecting your routes into our core network and vice versa. And
yep,
that can, if it's done wrong, it can absolutely cause havoc, yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It went wrong one time. I remember that.
Yep.
All right. So, I'm all about app dev here. So happy to see .NET Core 2.0 support for App Service on Linux has been GA now, just yesterday, actually. And it's an interesting model, right? They use containers to support all these different stacks on the App Service for Linux. So they have this base container stack, and then you have your application, and it gets applied onto that base image, and then they spit out a new image, and they run that in Linux for you. So it's a very interesting model.
Might be interesting to get somebody on to talk about that some, because I'm not sure if I totally get the value proposition of a Linux web app using .NET Core. I guess so that you can use other Linux things within the container. I mean, that's the value proposition at that point. You can kind of mix and match as you see fit.
Well, I suppose I can address that since my team owns that. I think it's a point-in-time thing until Windows containers are available. Obviously, in some cases, the Linux containers with .NET Core are faster. And as you said, you have the ability to add some Linux-specific things, like if you need some funky extensions for, Python or other things you want to call from your .NET app.
Right.
And finally, the whole thing of containers in app service is actually an interesting experiment, because we're seeing a lot of folks who like containers but don't want to mess with orchestrators, right? So We see them uploading the containers and running them on app service.
Oh, so then you then you don't have to deal with orchestration at that point. Ah, okay, I get that. Okay.
Right.
Well, we may have to have you back then.
Yeah. Oh, someone more knowledgeable for my team.
But it's an interesting point generally, though, isn't it, as to, you know, whether you want to run your thing on Linux or Windows. I mean, if you're running it and it is pure .NET core, does it really matter? You know, as a developer, you don't really care, do you?
I agree with that sentiment, yeah. And that's come up with our customer as well recently, because we're looking at Kubernetes and containers there as well. That's only available on Linux right now, at least in AKS. And the question does come up, hey, should we wait for the Windows thing, or hey, why don't we just put, we're doing .NET anyways, why does it matter? And for the most part, as Neeraj said, it is faster. That's been my first experience. It is actually significantly faster than the Windows version, not only in standing up the container, which, as you know, the Linux containers are very small compared to the Windows containers, but the app, the .NET app will run faster, or start up faster at least on top of that. So it's a really eye-opening experience for me.
Interesting. So the last one.
Yeah, having said that, there's still a lot of value in Windows containers for sort of the lift and shift to older .NET versions.
Yeah, right.
And we see a lot of customers that are getting a lot of savings by running many containers on one hardware, because these Windows apps don't get run as much. So I think there's a place for everything there.
Yeah, we're going to have to, at some point, we're going to have to publicly say we love Windows, like we say we love Linux, right?
We haven't forgotten about Windows.
None of us thought we'll ever have this conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Russell, you were going to pick up something?
Yeah, no, just the last one of the updates on the list there that I noticed. The Azure Search now gets enterprise security on data encryption at rest is on by default, and that's all managed by Microsoft, so you don't have to worry about key management and anything like that. It's just on. You can't turn it off or anything like that. It's there. And it's using that strong 256-bit AES encryption. So that's all good stuff. And the other interesting thing they've added to Azure Search is this user identity access control. So it's leveraging Azure AD to enable you to do things like filter the results that come out from a search. So if the user who's making the query call through the SDK hasn't got rights to see some of the data, then that data won't be made visible by results. That's pretty cool.
Nice.
Be like data masking, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there was one more update in there, and that's the ITSM connector for Azure. That's now generally available. And these are tools like ServiceNow, Province, etc., right? These are customers have other tools to manage their IT infrastructure internally, just, you know, the servicing of those of the infrastructure. And there's a requirement for those tools to get information from Azure, for example, to, you know, to see what the health is and things like that. And so we're providing this connector now so they can easily plug into Azure, like the Azure Monitor, like we talked about last week, putting out all those events and things like that. And so they can, you know, just hook onto that event hub endpoint and get all those events coming in and do something with it. So that thing is now GA. That connector is now GA.
Yeah, sorry, I did see that one, but I'm app dev, so infrastructure is just...
It's just that hidden stuff underneath that just works, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's a good round of updates. So let's turn the mic over to our special guest, Nir. And you know, I'm sure our listeners recall you about a couple of years ago. You had introduced Functions to our listeners, and ever since then, I think it's fair to say that Functions has taken off dramatically, and it's become something that is in every conversation that I have with every customer that I go to see. I mean, as a consulting role, I speak to many customers, and they all talk about Functions. So reintroduce yourself just for, so in case some of our newer listeners don't know who you are, and let us know what's up and the latest stuff in the function space.
Oh, for sure. So my name is Nir. I'm the product management director for actually a bunch of PaaS product in Azure. So my team works on Azure App Service in all its different flavors, as well as Azure Functions, Azure Logic Apps, and Azure API Management. So we sort of have a portfolio of platform as a service, compute services. So it's very rewarding to see the growth of Functions, and it's very interesting to look at all of these things fitting together and what customers are really doing with that. In terms of Functions, yes, it's been amazing. We've been I think we introduced functions in April, 2016, and we GA'd in November 2016. So we had a sort of a year on the running, and we've seen huge growth in terms of definitely mindshare, customer interest, and interesting use cases. Just like Sujit mentioned, I talk to a lot of customers as well, and we're seeing these interesting sort of patterns emerging with functions. So I guess everyone knows what those are. Should I talk about what they are?
Yeah, maybe a one or two sentence description for somebody who maybe hasn't heard it before.
Yeah, so I think with functions, we talk a lot about serverless compute, but it's a flavor of serverless compute, I suppose, where you only pay for execution of your code, but most importantly, you're also isolated from a lot of the chores and plumbing to build your code. So it's really a play around the ease of development and productivity. So, and we all know that. Imagine I just need to build a web API to talk to Cosmos DB. If I do it in quote unquote the traditional way with app service or API apps, so I have to set up a project in Visual Studio, I have to import the template, I'll end up with thousands of lines of code that I don't know, that I don't have a clue what they do, because they talk to all these other libraries, and even though I only have to probably write my code in very, very few places, I still have all of these things to worry about, right? I have to run it somewhere, I have to make sure my connections are handled correctly, and so on. With functions, all I will do is I'll go and create a function with an HTTP trigger, meaning our infrastructure will invoke your code every time that this HTTP trigger is invoked. You can get a custom domain for it, you get SSL, you get calls in order to use it as a AJAX call. And if you want to connect to an external database, all you do is add a binding. You're just going to tell the functions runtime, hey, I want to write into this variable that I get in my function signature, and that's where my data will go. So it makes the whole model or paradigm very portable, because I will write the same code in order to output into Azure Storage Queue, Azure Table Queue, or SQL Database, or NoSQL Database. And it hides a lot of the complexity and the places we make mistakes and may break all of our friends in our team. So that's very exciting. Again, because it makes development so easy, we see a lot of traction in the serverless space. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to just make a comment. I think if I recall, when Functions was first released, we supported maybe .NET as a language, mm-hmm. right? And I think was Node.js originally there. I don't recall now. Has there been any growth there, or any other like languages or frameworks that we support over the years?
Yeah, for sure. So we are now in a preview of what we call the Function 2.0 runtime. It's actually a port of the function SDK, if you will, to .NET 2.0, which allows us to run it on Linux environments. We also changed the architecture to make languages be decoupled from the SDK piece, which means you can essentially, by obeying some of our interfaces, you can sort of bring your own language. The first language we brought in was Java, and that's been in preview for a few months. And we're currently working on Python. Later this year, we will probably release our language worker as a supported API, so customers and partners can go and bring their own languages as well. Since Azure Functions is all open source project, it's all on GitHub. We don't have any secrets. You can go take a look yourself and see how these things are implemented, including our Java implementation. So that's very exciting, because we're now even more open than we were before. The other byproduct of moving to .NET 2.0 is the ability to run on the edge and run in different environments. So we produced a bunch of Docker containers with the functions runtime, and they're available on Docker Hub. They're also available as a supported stack on the Azure App Service for containers. So we already see customers running that on Kubernetes People are afraid of vendor lock-in, but like the Azure Function development model, are now more than welcome to deploy into a container and go run it somewhere else. And they'll still get our great experience with Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, and so on. So we're very proud of where it's going and how we're really keeping sort of the promise of openness, if you will.
Well, that's amazing. Again, but I didn't know that you could do that. You could just take it to put it in a container and run it anywhere. So
yeah, I actually have I travel around now with a Raspberry Pi that has one of these sensors for temperature and an LCD screen, and I have the Azure Functions runtime running on the Pi, listening to messages coming from an Azure queue.
Lovely.
That's just cool. Can end up with. You know, I can sit in my office and see what the temperature is in my house, as well as literally integrate, Twitter search to Logic Apps to Azure Q to an Azure Function on a device and show that to the audience while we do our demo.
So that really allows us, I mean, by doing that, we've kind of democratized the, you know, not just the microservices, because that's coming in through a bunch of different areas and obviously mm-hmm. serverless plays in microservices, but now with the .NET 2.0 core, you can now democratize kind of where it runs as well. I think that's kind of your point about the edge. I can now do this on any device that can run .NET 2.0 core.
Correct. And that's sort of this notion of functions everywhere, because what we're seeing from customers is, hey, this is a really cool way to build applications. I have these micro or nano services, but in some cases, my unit of execution cannot be on the public cloud because of latencies, or cannot be on the public cloud because of compliance or data privacy. And what we can tell them now is, hey, build the same code, run it where it makes sense to you.
Right.
So we're seeing, again, a lot of excitement and traction on that.
And I can see a big demand for that for folks who want to run it on-premises, right? Within your data center, if they want a function like experience inside. Is that something that you see?
Yeah, we're seeing some government agency here and abroad saying, hey, again, we like the programming model. We have a bunch of resources sitting on-prem. We can use the function runtime to process data or do whatever we need.
How does that, when you start pushing out to those devices, so one of the niceties of the cloud, which I having come from the on-premises world like a lot of us, I don't miss dealing with setup and install and upgrade mm-hmm. quite in the same fashion. How are you tackling that with, because now you have this runtime running on a device, well, now you have an update for that.
Yep.
Is that part of the model, or is that kind of underneath you and you're just running the code on top of whatever that runtime is? Like, is that inherent in what you're trying to push out, is that update concept?
Yes, I think here, and that's true across the board, not just for functions, there is some of the magic of containers that's really helpful, is because if your base container sits on a public location, you can update it as a vendor, and then it's up to the customer to decide how they want to upgrade it
right.
or update it, but they can do it based on their own needs, or they can have their own private version. We've not gotten to the point or the level of maturity that says, hey, we should get into the business of managing
pushing
these things
updates.
And yeah. pushing updates. But I think that's where the transformational value of containers is really playing out. Because years ago, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, we would have said, yeah, this is a great idea, but getting this SDK to run in a stable way on all the different permutations and all of these OSs will be something we can't tackle. Today we have a container, we run a container, it's great. So
yes, you just run it in the container. As long as the container runs on that environment, you don't care. You're in the container.
Yeah.
Nice.
Now, Nir, I know the, mm-hmm. the original promise for containers or the use case was, you know, short duration functions, right? Something mm-hmm. that you had to just run for a few, I don't know, relatively small programs. Mm-hmm. Give us some examples of some unexpected use cases for functions that you may have seen that don't fit this model.
I think that if you get people who are all into this model, so first thing, we had a restriction of 5 minutes for runtime on a function, and we lifted that restriction and went to up to 10 minutes. And we can also, unlike our competitors, you can run functions on, again, either on your, bring your own Kubernetes or container infrastructure, but also an app service, which gives you sort of a range of knobs to play with in your configuration. So we see a lot of people, again, just do this data processing. What I've seen that is surprising to an extent is the traction we're seeing from like really, top vendors, or top companies that are taking a dependency on the serverless model. And for example, I think they discussed it in public in Ignite last year, so I can talk about it. Boeing is using functions as part of their processing of sort of a messaging bus that they're using internally for all their applications. So I think that if anything, we're always surprised by how people kind of reimagine and build these end-to-end applications. The other use case we're seeing is sort of, I call it, practical microservice infrastructure is where you have different endpoints coming from different systems. Some of them are implemented as functions, and then customers are using a feature that we've recently GA'd called Azure Function Proxies, which is basically a small version of Azure API Management that you can run together with your function for without having to pay extra. And that gives you a rudimentary capabilities of APIM. You can do the reverse proxy. You can do payload transformation. You can do more KPIs. So we're seeing people that are actually starting to take this dependency to build composed applications, where you have one REST API that is behind the scene has a bunch of different endpoints. And then there's a very natural, with the magic of Swagger, there's a very natural upgrade into full-fledged Azure API management, where you can get your developer portal and throttling and monetization and so on. So that's a pattern that, again, moved much faster than we expected as far as customer traction. Mostly we saw it when we had a before we GA'd the proxies, we had a breaking change, and many, many more customers than we expected started complaining. obviously, we fixed the problem, but we're definitely seeing kind of people building these applications.
That's amazing. That's a really cool idea. I don't know about this mini API management layer that you put in there, because that so then each of these functions that you write are actually little microservices by themselves, and then you front-end them with this mini APIM layer. Is that how you describe
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so you can use the mini APIM layer to connect to not just one Azure function, but to many of them, and you can also connect to other things like a Logic App or anything that has an HTTP endpoint, basic, which means that you can, again, compose stuff that is more diverse than just one framework. So with some of these microservices frameworks, like Java Spring, for example, you're sort of required to build all these microservices in the same way, which actually negates the whole point of microservices, which is each team does their own thing. So we've seen that the really practical and implementation of microservices for people to get a proxy and make all these diverse APIs look the same.
That's just really amazing. So how does failure or failover work in that scenario, right? That's one of the other things that people want. Like, if they're going to be able to look up a microservice, I don't know how the mini. I've not looked at the mini API yet. But how does it look up a service endpoint, and what if that service endpoint is unavailable? Like, what exactly happens there?
So, as far as monitoring and so on, we've GA'd our support of App Insights. So it's trivial to add App Insights to your application, and there's a reference the pieces so you can see how things connect to each other. As far as service discovery at this point, we trust DNS, meaning you should, in some cases, you should use the App Gateway or Traffic Manager on top of your endpoints. You could also essentially treat it as an asynchronous process and say, hey, I'll have one entry point with a bunch of functions in different geo-regions, and then whoever gets the message first.
I like your idea that each of these microservices now, or these functions, can be written in different languages by different teams, right? Using a different stack in some cases. And so you're not tying them down into using a common infrastructure.
It doesn't have to be functions.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have to be functions. They can use containers, or they can expose an existing monolith application. So I think that as people that work with customers, we see that cloud transformation and digital transformation is a continuum. It's a process, right? And you can't expect people to dump everything they have and just jump into it. It takes time. So by providing all these integration capabilities and the ability to have a proxy on upfront that makes everything looks restified, we're allowing people to progress in their own pace.
I think I'm not sure if you just coined that new verb, but we'll have to use that again. Like restified.
Restified, I like it, yeah. And you even talked about how you can throw Swagger on top of all that. So, hey, all the app devs out there are getting all excited. I can see it now. That's really cool, though, Nir. Great insight into that feature in functions and how it can be used for something like a microservice architecture. So, what are the plans for what are the like future plans for functions that you can say out here in the public?
So, your question was what's next that we can talk about.
Right.
So, pretty much everything we have in preview stages now, we're working really hard to fix, so to get to production or GA. So certainly stuff like Java, upcoming Python support, our V2 runtime, as well as we've gotten a bunch of really great and justified feedback around some of our scalability numbers, and the team is really heads down on fixing that and making sure that we meet our customers' expectations. And so a few blog articles about comparing our scalability for HTTP triggers, and we took those to heart, and our customers should expect some really great progress in the next few.
Now, I know that, I don't know if it's still the case, though, but functions used to be part of the overall app services, right? And we had that, I know a customer was trying to go to ASC at some point, and functions was not available as part of ASC. Is that correct?
Yeah, so most of that stuff is fixed. So functions is available on the isolated SKU as well as on Azure Stack. In our China cloud and our German national cloud, it's available, but the portal's not there yet. So you can use Visual Studio or Visual Studio Code to develop in them, but they're not in the portal. That's getting fixed in the next I think sometime in February as well.
Cool. Very good. Glad to hear that. So a lot of progress in the function space. Awesome. Well, guys, any more questions for Nir before we let him go?
Just on that, the API management functionality that you mentioned, the mini API management, is that a feature of API management or is that a feature of functions? Is it just a SKU?
It was released as a feature that just went GA called Azure Functions Proxy.
It's part of that, is it? Right, okay.
Yeah. However, it uses the same code as APIM. It's literally we share the same builds of our DLLs. And there's going to be features built into the portal to enable you to kind of manage a bunch of proxies from an APIM instance. Right now, you can do it pretty quickly by creating a Swagger form, because there's an automatic Swagger generation or help to generate a Swagger from the function, and you can put that into your APIM.
Yeah, functions proxies was a really good innovation, I think. There's not many conversations I have these days with customers or partners where functions isn't a really good viable option for them. And generally, once they start playing with it, that's it, and you can't sort of turn them away from it. They just want to do everything in functions. Yeah. So it's great.
Well, that's what we love to hear, and then we're out there on GitHub, and we're very, very responsive. All of our development is on our functions repository, I believe under Azure, and when customers open issues, we'll address them, and then we're also very, very active on our Twitter feed, so at Azure Functions, we'll get you support and interactions directly with myself and my team.
That's good to hear.
That's amazing. I got to give you guys kudos as well, Nir. I mean, the fact that you just kind of blithely just said, yeah, we'll have this new functionality available in a couple of weeks. Like, we do realize how amazing that is, right? That we're going to have new functionality for something that's, you know, still kind of a nascent technology in weeks, right? Not months or years like yeah. we used to talk about. So, no, it's great to see this product go. I'm kind of with Russell. Every time I think about something that I want to do, I'm starting to think about functions first, because most of what I do is, you know, kind of small proof of concept mm-hmm. stuff, and it's perfect for those kind of things. I don't have to deal with the infrastructure, even when I don't have to deal with traditional infrastructure with web apps. Now I don't even have to deal with the web apps piece, right? I just put the core yeah. parts I need, and it works great. So, no, great product.
Yeah, and that's what we're looking to be able to say to customers is, hey, if you need to build something, tie with functions. If that's not good enough, you can tie it with app service. That doesn't work, tie with containers, container orchestrators. And then as a last resort, if you will, and if you really need control and some very specialized stuff, you can go and use you can use IaaS or obviously stuff like Service Fabric or Azure Patch.
Right. Cool. No, great. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Nir. Okay.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.